What is up, everyone? I hope you're having a wonderful 2023. Inside the War Room is, of course, here, ready to go. A lot of shows this year to put out. Two things you can do to support us. One, give a 5-star rating wherever you listen to this podcast, a like, a thumbs up, subscribe, whatever that looks like on your platform. We would greatly appreciate it. Two, if you want to support the show, you can do that by going to warroommedia.com. That keeps the ads off. That keeps us rolling. It covers our cost. We would really, really appreciate that. Warroommedia.com. Marion, welcome to the War Room.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. The book is Superabundance, the story of population growth, innovation, and human flourishing on an infinitely bountiful planet. That's a bold claim because we hear a lot of doom and gloom about overpopulation, lack of food, scarcity of resources. What's going on with this book?
Well, I guess part of the reason for writing it is precisely because the world is filled with this doom and gloom. I mean, you can't open a newspaper without reading a story about some sort of looming catastrophe, which never seems to materialize. But also increasingly, we are seeing news stories treating humanity as a danger to the planet, talking about humans as a cancer on the planet, talking about bringing children into the world as an act of selfishness, talking about how the world would be a much better place if we all committed a collective suicide as a species. I mean, these are serious academics making these points. And then writing about them in the New York Times and the Washington Post. And so I think that the logical thing to do was to look at what is happening to population and resources and to try to figure out what exactly is going on. And what we did was to find the exact opposite, which is to say that as population grows, things are becoming cheaper, not more expensive.
Yeah, and it's I don't know this to be true. I do wonder if human rights issues or poverty issues or food scarcity issues are more of a concern today because, at least in the West, we have the ability to be concerned about those things, which means me and you are sitting here talking on a podcast. We're not out in the field working to make sure that we have food for, you know, the summer and the winter, et cetera. And so I've wondered as nations become more developed and you have more time to sit and to think and to do things, if you begin to worry about those things, which is not wrong, but, you know, in 1300, perhaps it was just as bad, if not worse, but you couldn't really sit around and think about it a lot because you were just out doing your job daily.
Well, without question, life was much worse in 1300. In fact, I would argue that life was much worse in 1950 than it is today. Just the numbers don't lie on this subject. But yes, what you said is true. In fact, we do have now psychological papers and research in lab showing that there is such a thing as a concept creep that happens as societies evolve. A perfect example of that would be something like the issue of slavery. Until very recently, everybody understood that when you said the word slavery, what you meant was chattel slavery, people being kept in irons and being essentially a possession of other people. But now, as we have gotten rid of that problem, people are talking about wage slavery, which is to say that I have to wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning to make it to Cato at 9 o'clock. That is considered wage slavery because I have to work for a living. People are talking about, all sorts of other slaveries, which of course, are of a much lesser impact, issue, concern than chattel slavery was in the 18th and 19th centuries. So the point is that we keep on redefining problems upwards, and whenever we sort of tackle a problem, we will then extend it, enlarge it, so that we continue to have things to worry about. But that seems to happen all the time, yes.
Yeah, that's a great point, which is whatever you want to say about the current labor market today, when you call it slavery, you're invoking something from you know, as you mentioned, chattel slavery there. And you're not really... You're claiming it's modern day slavery, and we can talk about labor laws or whatever. That's a fine discussion to have, but you've kind of moved the goalpost of what slavery was and what kind of people agreed on what was right and wrong to now this modern issue. And it's not the same on a lot of levels because there is actually modern day slaves in certain parts of the world still that has not been eradicated. And so to call wage slavery something is a little bit of a misnomer. And so it feels like some of these arguments, they almost should have a time period in which you can use the term. And like, you can no longer say, hey, this term is now related to this term, because it's a different era. It's a different argument. And so but we have this continuation, which makes it hard to pause and reflect. So if you look at somewhere like China, and you talk about being better, China today is the best it's ever been. Let's take the geopolitical risk and threat and all that stuff out of it. But just from a standard of living, it's better than it's been in the last 100 years. It's not even close. And what you see is as a result of that, their pollution, there's people who get frustrated over pollution. The drinking water is better. As the standard of living is rising, the population has a different perception of what they want to live in or what they will tolerate. Whereas in 60 years ago, they would live in a rice field working, trying to make ends meet. And so when we move through these decades and we kind of think about stuff, it seems that as populations get wealthier, not only do they maybe focus on different issues, they also demand certain things of society, which is a better quality of living across the board.
Yeah, you can think of it also in terms of the Maslow pyramid of needs or hierarchy of needs. No, I think it's the pyramid of needs. The point is that at the bottom of the pyramid, you've got things like basic daily security that you don't want to have, marauding tribes coming through a village and killing and pillaging and whatever. You have to have access to basic food, water, shelter. And then you keep on moving up this pyramid of needs until you get to the very top, which is all about self-actualization. And part of self-actualization, it goes beyond friendship and family. Self-actualization is basically to live in a society that reflects your own sort of perceived ideal of a good society. So the problem with that, of course, is that your idea of what an ideal society should be like can be very different from mine. And I think that part of the reason, one of the hypotheses I have, is that part of the reason why we are so much at each other's throats and why society is so polarized is because when you think about it, we have moved up that pyramid of needs. All of our basic necessities are taken care of. And so what we are left with is this final bit, which is self-actualization, living in a society where your ideas about freedom may be very different from my ideas about equality and that sort of thing. You know, some of us may emphasize risk. Others may be much less risk prone. Some people may be maybe liberty oriented, others equality oriented. Some people want to keep more of their taxes. Other people want to have greater redistribution of wealth. The point is that polarization is precisely increasing because you have all of us essentially having, as you said, nothing more important or better to do.
How much do you think the lack of scarcity plays into this? So you talk about this ascension, and I agree that's part of it, but also the lack of scarcity gives us this illusion that we can kind of do a lot more than we probably can. And we kind of, I think if one thing people should have learned from COVID was when you shut down supply chains and you start them going again, it's really hard to get that process going. But we live, generally speaking, in a world West where you don't have scarce resources, at least from our perspective, the consumer's perspective. We don't understand what it takes to obviously roll up something new. So do you think that we don't appreciate scarcity enough? And so therefore we're not thinking properly about these decisions that you talk about, because we just assume that everything is infinite.
Okay. So there's a lot in there. One answer that I would give is that we have also lost a sense of where all this abundance comes from. People can get on TV or on radio or on podcasts and talk the biggest nonsense because they have no idea how a piece of corn or a bushel of wheat is actually grown, So right now, for example, the Dutch government is trying to shut down something like 1/3 of farms in Holland because they are not up to speed on the latest environmental concerns, right? But what will happen if if suddenly we cannot produce food. And you know, my point is that very often I think the problem is that people no longer people don't understand. We are so far divorced from our past living as farmers that we no longer appreciate the sophistication and the hard work that goes into the provision of food. So I think that's one problem. The other is what you said is that we no longer worry about food because the shops are always full, or at least they were before COVID. And that may lure us into a false sense of security, thinking that we can fiddle with the economic and political system without negative consequences down the line. So how shall I concretize this? Well, we all know that a lot of people around the world are concerned about the environment and are trying to ensure that human impact on the planet is as minimal as possible. And to achieve that, there appears to be no law, no regulation, no punishment that they are unwilling to countenance in order to bring about that time or era of environmental protection of the highest order. But if you break down these systems of supply and demand, when you break down the ability of the farmers to actually produce food, then you can end up in a situation where the shops will be permanently empty. So I guess that's a long way of saying that our lack of understanding of the sophistication that goes into the food supply systems, and then our obsession with tinkering with the socioeconomic system may be actually undermining superabundance in the long term.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought the food issue up. I watched the debate, a discussion between a popular Republican and Democrat last night, and it was a very friendly discussion. And the Democrat said that she used to be against nuclear energy, but now she's for it because she realizes that renewables can't replace fossil fuels, oil and gas particularly, and coal. And they went on about that. And to me, it was stunning on a couple levels. A, she's right that renewables can't replace fossil fuels. But B, nuclear can't replace oil and gas because petrochemicals and the products that oil and gas make, everything that I can see in your room and you can see in my room, comes from oil and gas. It's made through a process, through petrochemicals. And so even then, when you talk about how things come and how things are made, even then, while I appreciate her admission that nuclear is important, there's still a huge gap that energy, the oil, gas, don't just make energy. They also make products. And so even there, you can see where people having a debate over how society should function don't even understand the outputs of what these things, what these products can do. And so the corn example is also an interesting one because you start messing with all these things and it's not as if you just canceled an order on Amazon, but we treat it like it is, right? Like, oh, we're going to cancel this order, get our money back. Everything's going to be easy, but that's not how it works. And to me, it's quite frustrating. And so is this that the experts, to use that term, are misleading us? Is it that people have good intentions and they overestimate their ability to make changes? Why is it that we think we can make these radical changes to society and not pay consequences for them?
I think, look, again, it's just a hypothesis, but I think that environment has sort of morphed into a secular religion of a kind. Obviously, Western societies are becoming much more secular over time. I don't take a position on this, whether you believe in God or not, I don't care. I'm an atheist myself. But the point is that, as G.K. Chesterton said, when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything. And I think that environmentalism has started creeping in as a sort of quasi-new religion, because it gives structure to people's values, it gives structure to people's lives, they have something to live for, they can see themselves pursuing some sort of a heroic mission of saving the planet, It's very interesting to me how Christian religion maps onto environmental religion with, you know, planet before industrialization as the Garden of Eden, you know, saints like Greta Thunberg, priesthood like the IPCC and that sort of thing, even the devils, the fossil fuel companies. And I think that for a lot of people, environmentalism simply fulfills that deep need to believe in something transcendental, it fulfills that need very profoundly, and that is why they are wedded to it, regardless of the contradictions that they see or that they encounter within it. A perfect example would be the nuclear issue that you have mentioned. We have known for a long time that nuclear can help dramatically with the reduction of the CO2 emissions, but because nuclear is quote unquote unnatural, you know, it is not wind and solar, it has been opposed for 40-50 years. We also know that we can limit the amount of pesticide we use in order to grow our crops and the amount of fertilizer by genetically modifying the crops that we grow in order to eat them. Once again, the green religion says no. So even though it's self-defeating, you know, we are emitting much more CO2 in the atmosphere than we would have to if we use nuclear. They are still against it, precisely because this is not an attempt to solve a problem. This is an attempt to maintain a religious belief, quasi-religious belief. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it goes to, and I see this across the board, is the question, and we talk about this on the show a lot, epistemology. How do we know things? And a lot of what we argue is based upon things that we don't really know, or we think we know. And I don't talk about maybe at an expert level, but just amongst the people, popular understanding. To your point about nuclear, obviously, It's you know, to my baseload capacity, it's a great source. It's reliable. It's there. But most people don't understand what goes into building a nuclear plant, the cost to build one, the permits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or the trade-offs, as you mentioned there. And so it becomes this kind of political football that people bounce back and forth instead of actually thinking about a hierarchy of morals or a hierarchy of priority and say, okay, well, you know, if reducing CO2 emissions is the number one thing, then nuclear is better than oil, gas, or coal. Okay, if that's the number one thing, then it is. But then there's a separate debate about a potential meltdown, and all of a sudden, well, it's like, well, which one is the top concern? And as a society, we just don't do a good job of fleshing that out.
No, we don't. I mean, just to explore this issue a little more, I mean, you know, the American government both undermines and it tries to subsidize nuclear power. So on the one hand, you've got parts of the government which are pushing more money into atomic research and into guaranteeing the prices for nuclear energy. On the other hand, you've got other parts of the government which are increasing the regulatory burden of building of nuclear power plants to such extent that it makes them prohibitively expensive. So there is this insanity of one of the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. But I also want to, I just want to circle back to what I was saying as environmentalism, as a religion. If it was just a religion, it wouldn't work. I think there is something else going on. You are familiar with that concept of Baptists and bootleggers. It's an economics concept which basically says that in order for a policy to succeed, it's best if you have the moralists and the unscrupulous profiteers on the same page. So a perfect example would be the abolishment of drinking or alcohol in the United States in the 1920s. What you wanted was both to have the proselytizers, the Christian opponents of drinking, but you also wanted to have on your side the bootleggers, because they knew that when alcohol becomes more expensive, they are going to make more money, right? And I think the similar thing is happening both in this green thing, is that on the one hand, you've got people who truly firmly believe in the green religion. It is part of their lives. It is who they are. You're not going to change their minds. On the other hand, however, you do have a lot of interests who are making a ton of money from the green transition, and it is the coalition between these two which makes it so difficult to so difficult for people to have a rational conversation. Because if you go to Davos, okay, and you see and hear, I didn't go, but I've seen a lot of videos and I've read a lot of newspaper reports. Basically, here you have the richest people in the world, very often the captains of industry, responsible for hundreds of thousands of jobs, mouthing the same green nonsense as you would expect from Greta Thunberg. Now, you ask yourself, why are they doing this? They are not irrational people. But they are doing it because that's where the money is, right? It's the money and the social approval. That's also very important, because the last thing that you want to do is to be known as a climate denier. Whereas if you say all the right things in Davos, you make your propitiation to the green religion, and at the same time you're able to bring $1 billion in profits to your company, then good for you.
Yeah, it is stunning on the Davos example. I mean, I've got Bill Gates' book over there, How to Prevent Climate Disaster, whatever it's called. And it's stunning to read the book, because he opens up by talking about how I'm not trying to impute anything with what he says. He just says he's dealing with private industry and governments to get certain policies passed. And it's like, well, okay, if I said the CEO of Exxon was saying that, which he's doing that, to be clear, the CEO of Exxon is doing the same thing. But if I said the CEO of Exxon said that he's working with industry and government to get policies passed, people would lose their mind. They'd be like, oh my gosh, ExxonMobil's manipulating the government. This is the worst thing ever. And it's like, well, okay, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But here's Gates saying this. Here's Gates admitting that he doesn't really reduce his carbon footprint. He just goes and invests in companies that theoretically do, so that he can still fly around. Well, you and me are doing this over Zoom because it's more cost effective. It's cheaper. It doesn't make sense for me to fly out to wherever you're at and meet with you. This makes sense. And we can do it and have a great conversation. Bill Gates surely can hop on Zoom, and anyone in the world would get on and listen to him and take him seriously. He doesn't actually need to fly to be anywhere. He needs it less than me and you needed. Furthermore, Gates bought a house in San Diego on the beach. And so, to your point, people don't want to be accused of being a climate denier. But on the other hand, the frustration is that the practical questions aren't being asked. How is it, to your point, the titans of industry can all fly to Davos when they can get on the phone with anyone they want in the world at any time and make a deal? Why is it that Bill Gates can buy a house on the beach if he's so afraid of these things? And I'm not saying that they're incompatible. I'm saying, why are these questions that being put forth? And it causes this duality of, on one side, there's an overreaction to any time something climate related is talked about. And it's the same thing on the other side. And so you can't ever have this conversation, because the actors who are talking about this at a popular level are quite inconsistent and are quite motivated by money. And then the rest of us have to suffer the consequences of asking questions about their motivations.
Yeah, I mean, the perfect example of this would be somebody like Emma Thompson, a very famous English actor who lives in Los Angeles. She took a first-class flight. She was photographed on the flight, first-class flight from LA to London in order to take part in a green protest. I believe like the next day she flew back again. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about tremendous inconsistency. And I think that's part of the reason why this whole thing is beginning to fall apart. More and more people, ordinary people like you and me, are looking at this and thinking, you know what, I'm actually going to speak out, because the level of hypocrisy that you see happening with this green religion is just staggering. Bill Gates, I think, is one of those few people who actually believes it and wants to make money out of it. I think that 99% of people in Davos don't believe it, but want to make money out of it. And then, as I said, there are people who are true believers. But those of us who just want a solution to a problem, who want us to have a rational discussion, are seeing people like Al Gore buying 6 houses, palatial style houses, and thinking, how is this possible? How can this person go on TV and say that oceans are literally boiling you know, when his own carbon footprint is so high. And I think hypocrisy of these people is part of the reason why the whole thing is falling apart. But also, I think much more important is what happened in Europe last winter after Putin invaded Ukraine. And that is that we realized how incredibly important fossil fuels continue to be. Mm-hmm. And the machinations of the European governments over the last 20 to 30 years to change the grid to rely increasingly on solar and wind was simply not sufficient, that it was the wrong way to go. Part of the reason why Macron has now committed to building more nuclear power plants in France. Part of the reason why the British government is now increasingly looking into small modular reactors for the UK, Slovakia, Poland have all committed to building more nuclear power stations is because everybody understands that solar and wind are simply not the answer in the short run, in the medium run. And I would probably say that never, because never say never, because of course I'm a techno-optimist. It's possible that at some point in the future we are going to have hyper-efficient batteries where we'll be able to store enough electricity to power civilization even at night or on a windless days. But still, the point is that we are stuck with nuclear fuels for a very long time. We can ameliorate the problem of CO2 emissions by nuclear fusion and fission. But even that is probably not going to be even a medium-term solution to things like, for example, trucking or air travel over long distances and everywhere else where you need high concentrated and small volume power, such as oil provides in trucks and things like that.
Yeah. And to be clear, I have no idea whether Gates believes it or not. My point with him is, if he believes it to the extent he does, he should move to Kansas and not fly and lead by example. That would be my point. And people should press that on him. If you show us, you can have a mansion in Kansas, I'm cool with that, but just lead by example, Zoom all day and lead by example. That's what leaders do. They don't say, I'm going to offset my carbon footprint by investing in companies that, just to be clear, me and you will never, you might check them, but I'm not going to track these companies and know if they're successful or not. So that is the frustration there. So let's get back to food. But it's all tied together, right? If you look at somewhere like sub-Saharan Africa, they need access to clean or cheap, reliable energy, at least. They want this energy, but they also need food production as well. So you're saying, your argument that you started off with was, it's the best time in human history. I actually agree with that. But people looking at, you know, Honduras, Nicaragua, parts of sub-Saharan, South Africa, South America, what would you say to them about, they're going, it's obviously not great there. What would you say to them?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't, I certainly wouldn't want to minimize the suffering that's still around the world when we are talking about superabundance. You know, we are talking about superabundance within the context of advanced economies. There are plenty of places in the world where people continue to have serious problems and going to continue into the future. What I'm saying is that for the first time in human history, we no longer have famines in the world, like proper famines where entire regions die out because there is a lack of food. That's partly because outside of war zones, I need to point that out. There are still times when there is a war zone, like in Yemen, in, you know, 2 or 3 years ago when there was a famine. But outside of war zones, usually even the most primitive economies are now sophisticated enough to produce enough food. Alternatively, what happens is that can import it. And if they are so poor that they cannot import it, then the international community has enough food and enough of a warning mechanism, and transport is now so cheap that you are able to prevent famine from happening. So this is a tremendous change from the previous, you know, 12,000 years or so. Similarly, when it comes to life expectancy, I mean, throughout the world, I mean, people used to live to 25, 30. Now global life expectancy is about 73. So you know, there are good things happening. But what underdeveloped countries need really is to put into place the kinds of institutions that allowed advanced economies to become advanced economies. It is very difficult to sort of invest in places where you have no security of property rights, or where the president can take your factory, or the local police chief can expropriate your house. You know, these are not the sorts of things that we have to worry about too much in the advanced world, but throughout much of the world, this is a problem. You know, try to buy a house in the Caribbean or in Latin America and be certain that in case something happens, you can get a proper hearing in courts. You know, the rule of law, very, very important, which many of these countries don't. The technological know-how to bring even the most primitive economy into abundance is there, but whether it can be imported and whether it can be properly utilized will very much depend on the institutions in those countries. A perfect example of this would be two neighboring countries, Botswana and Zimbabwe. Botswana always had a rule of law, protection of property rights. It's been an incredible success story. Zimbabwe, basically, over the last 30 years has been disintegrating, and it's turned into a chaos, even though Zimbabwe historically was a much more prosperous country than Botswana. Again, they have very similar climate, very similar type of population. But what happened in Zimbabwe is that they basically they don't have property rights, and they don't have rule of law. They don't have a government that is restricted in its activities by accountability to the electorate. And so, you know, you have these situations like East and West Germany, like North and South Korea. It's not a question of culture. It's not a question of race. It's not a question of ethnicity. It's a question of economic institutions. Some work and some don't. And so long as some countries refuse to adopt these institutions, then they will be mired in shortages, and they will never reach superabundance.
Yeah, the rule of law is often overlooked. There was a few years ago, Mexico passed some energy reforms, and I remember the time going, okay, this is good for Mexico, but they need to stay in place for, you know, a long period of time, because you need to have lawsuits, you need to have contract disputes, you need to have all this stuff to see how it's going to work out, so more companies will go invest once they understand what the risk really is. Because it's great to say you've changed and you've opened up and you're more free market now, but until you go through these kind of legal battles, you don't know. And I think within 2-3 years, there's a new president and they roll back a lot of the reforms. It's like, well, okay, that's almost more damaging now, because if you go back in 3 more years and you reopen back up, people are going to be like, nah, I'm not too sure I want to go invest. The stability of these laws, because people think, if you're kind of not in the business world, you might think, well, they passed a law, it's great, we can go do it. But businesses want to see these court cases that they're going to be protected when something happens, because as a business owner, you know, you're likely going to get sued or a contract dispute at some point. So it's good laws, but it's also a good long, lengthy period of these laws being enforced matters as well.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Predictability in the regulatory environment, the tax environment, in trade environment is incredibly important from a perspective of long-term investment. Long-term investment is what makes the difference between poverty and riches. It's multinational companies, when they enter these developing countries, they bring with them a lot of tacit knowledge that can then be disseminated amongst the population. And if you don't have predictability of the regulatory tax and trade environment, then of course these multinational corporations are simply not going to come in. You're shooting yourself in the foot.
You mentioned property rights, and I have argued this for some time now. I'm curious your thoughts. The largest transfer of wealth in human history would be is if the governments of the world gave the mineral rights to the landowners. Because outside the U.S., there may be one other country where individual landowners can own minerals, but the U.S. is it. So if you live in Texas, you got the minerals, or whoever can, anyone can own them theoretically, but the government doesn't own them, right? You go to South Africa, they had privatized mineral rights. They took them back. I'm not sure you can do it with the flip of a switch because of some chaotic possibilities, but property rights, but subsurface property rights would be a huge game changer globally. And it's something that doesn't get talked about a lot. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on why that's not part of the discussion. That would generate so much wealth for the average person in these countries that you, I don't even know how you'd measure it. It would be unbelievable amount of wealth to be transferred.
Yeah, I wouldn't go as far as to say that that would be the greatest distribution of wealth, because I think that wealth primarily comes from technology than in natural resources. But you are right that America is a special case when it comes to subsurface mineral rights. And I can tell you from personal experience, I lived in South Africa at the time when the government decided to nationalize mineral rights. So South Africa historically had private mineral rights. That was just something that has evolved over time as farmers were buying plots of land and that sort of thing. It was never government owned. And then when the African National Congress and their communist allies came into power in 1994, they nationalized it. Now, that was a spectacular failure. Very few people understand that South Africa has completely missed out on the massive expansion of mining in the early 2000s, the first decade of this millennium, the first decade of this century. We had a massive commodity supercycle where countries all over the world were able to really benefit greatly from very high resource price. But because South Africa had this very unpredictable investment taxation and property right environment, basically its mining industry shrunk rather than expanding. So that sort of supports the point that you are making. But as I said, I think that a more important thing is actually spread of new technology and being able to utilize that technology, because most of our wealth is created through technological innovation rather than reliance on mineral rights.
Okay, let me push back there slightly to see if I can move you a smidge. First off, how you would transfer these minerals is a problem, and I'm not going to break all that down, but let's just assume that we did. When you transfer the mineral rights back to the landowners, and now you have created more wealth for the landowners. The landowners are going to employ people to build fences. Maybe they're going to buy fertilizer for the grass, whatever. They can now reinvest that money into their land. If it's a small tract, maybe they buy a new house. I don't know. That you've now infused the economy with money that was that's going to corrupt politicians is being wasted. I mean,
I agree with you. I think it would help. Yeah, there's no question. I think it would help greatly. Yes, absolutely. One thing that you want to do in any society is to leave as much money in the productive sector of the economy rather than the unproductive sector of the economy. And so, you know, that would help.
But what I'm ultimately getting into is that with technology, so medical technology or whatever it might be, you can't just bestow that to people. That doesn't work the same way. There has to be some kind of an economic force to bring that about, change in law, wealth, whatever. Here is something that you can that in my opinion is rightfully people's. You can give it back to them and then change their life forever. So that's what I'm talking about, the redistribution of the wealth. I'm saying that you should just give back what's theirs, and that would be the largest transfer of wealth in human history. With technology, it's something that the economy has to grow into, it would seem. So I'm what am I missing here on your side of the argument? Because to me, this is technology can't.
Well, what I'm saying is that as we show in superabundance, the thing is that mineral wealth continues to decline in price relative to labor. It's human labor, which is becoming more and more expensive because we are becoming more and more productive. But that's through technological change. So in other words, mineral wealth is actually becoming less and less important in terms of the value of the ultimate output, whatever it is that you are producing, the actual atoms which are contained in that product are constantly declining relative to the cost of human labor. And what is human labor? Human labor, why is it increasing in prices? Because it's becoming more productive. Why is it becoming more productive? It's because it's more intelligent, because it's relying on more technological oomph to help you to produce more. So what I'm saying is that I agree with you that that this should be done. But ultimately, I think that you know, you can get even more bang for the buck if you combine it. If you do that, but you also say, for example, open your borders to the import of
We don't disagree with you at all. Yeah.
Technologies, open your borders to the influx of capital and multinational organizations, multinational corporations, which will come in and they will hire 10,000 people and they can bestow on them all that tacit knowledge which is within these corporations, and consequently can increase the quality of the labor force and so forth.
Well, it's also it's the multinational, but it's also the little investor, the small business. You know, when I've looked at doing business in various parts of Africa, you start talking about local content laws and tax laws and all this stuff, and you're like, oh man, I can't afford to go pay some international attorney. I paid an international attorney to do one thing; it was a complete waste. So I'm not going to pay. Like, there's the multinational aspect. I do think that there's actually a nice runway for small business owners to work internationally, because they can bring some of this knowledge that you speak of, but they would also be far more dependent on working with locals to get that trade going there. But the laws are so cumbersome that it's hard to incentivize someone to go to these countries, because they're not sure what's going to happen with their money, their capital. Can they get it in? Can they get it out? What's the local content laws, paying bribes, all this stuff, where the multinationals can navigate that a lot easier. And so it the people who would have to invest practically really in the economy more, the small businesses, they're really hindered from going to these countries because of these laws, whereas the multinationals can navigate it a little bit easier. And so when you talk about opening up, I mean opening up in a way that you incentivize all levels of business to come to your country.
Yes. Look, we are not in disagreement in a sense that, of course, you want to enable a person at every level of economic activity to flourish in accordance with their God-given talents. So if somebody can only make a living and earn some profit by, say, cooking dinner for the workers passing by in a Kenyan village, you know, that's fine. What I'm saying is that it is very difficult to have an advanced economy where people have American standards of living based on small enterprises. Is that at some point, you've got to, if you want to reach our level of prosperity, you've got to scale up. And so there's no reason why you cannot have all of those things, provided that you are willing as a government to forego predatory behavior. And so long as you are willing to learn from the experience of advanced economies of what works and what doesn't. And what constantly amazes me about economic development around the world, and I've been working on this subject for what, quarter of a century, is that how difficult it is for countries to learn from each other's mistakes. It shouldn't be. Let's say that you have a president or a prime minister with all the power, you know, not something that libertarians are very keen on, obviously, and he or she is determined that they're going to prioritize the welfare of their people. Well, you just go around the world, see which type of economic activity, what works best, and then you implement it in your country. But that doesn't really happen very often. Countries are very unwilling to learn from mistakes abroad, and it's actually quite shocking. Even our own country, the United States, which is a very sophisticated society, we are refusing to learn. In Sweden, for example, you have for-profit secondary education. You can take your child anywhere. The money follows, whether it's a for-profit or a or a government or a government school. Yet that's something that apparently we cannot have. Post offices have been privatized all over the world, not in this country. Air control is privatized both in Canada and the United Kingdom, not exactly third world banana republics, yet we cannot have it here. So it's just very strange that that we can't learn.
Yeah, so I think we're on agreement. All I'm saying is the way the rules are in Africa, a lot of spots of Africa, is it benefits the multinationals who can go in there and they can play by these certain rules that small businesses can't play by. And if you want the economy to thrive, you need to have it to where there is competition from multiple levels, the small business all the way up to the ExxonMobil's. These complex laws don't allow that, not only from the Africa side, but the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the U.S. is a huge hindrance to companies going to work internationally as well. And so I'm not against multinational corporations by any stretch of the imagination. I would just suggest that the law structure now favors them because they can go pay these, you know, all these attorneys and CPAs and whomever to figure out how to navigate this stuff, whereas other people who want to come in and compete can't. And so you get a very skewed economy that breeds corruption even more so than if you were to open it up and allow actual competition, A, from the U.S. side, but also B, from the in-country side. So I'll let you respond there. I know we got to rep against the clock here. So
all of the above. I'm in favor of liberalization of entrepreneurial activity across the board. It should be as easy for a farmer or a cook or a hairdresser and a multinational corporation. You want everybody to have as easy way of doing business as you possibly can. Very often that's not the case. But I do believe that the only thing that I genuinely believe that the only thing that separates countries of superabundance, such as the United States, from countries which still face a lot of scarcity, is just adopting best practices, having the political will to change their ways. I don't believe that any country is beyond help, any country is beyond growth. I'm fully convinced that any country can become superabundant provided they have the right institutions in place.
Okay. We're going to link to the book in the show notes. Anywhere else you want us to send people to?
Well, people can check out superabundance.com, which talks about the book. They can buy the book on Amazon. They can check out humanprogress.org, which is where I work.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much for your time today. Enjoyed this.
My absolute pleasure.
Hey, you made it to the end of this episode. Thank you so much. Now, I'm going to ask a favor. If you enjoyed it, would you drop a 5-star somewhere? And if you really enjoyed it, would you consider becoming a subscribing member over at warroommedia.com? Helps keep the show going and ad-free. Thank you so much.